Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Every day's great at your GameBuoy.
Today is July 5th, 2015, and this is episode 86, Half a Persona, a GameBuoy spotlight on everybody's favorite Shin Megami Tensei spinoff. Except, of course, for those of you who really, really like Devil Summoner, I suppose. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, as you may have gathered, we're taking a look at the Persona sub-series of JRPG games. But before we get into that, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. So without further ado, Psyche McWaggy, you want to get us started?
Yes, Arc System Works has confirmed that they will be bringing Dragon Ball Z Extreme Butoden over to Western 3DSs. That's going to be releasing on October 20th, according to Bandai Namco.
Excellent, excellent. You know, I played this on my Japanese 3DS. I thought it was a pretty well-designed game, some really cool sprite work. I would recommend it. So if you're into Dragon Ball Z, please look forward to it. We also have word here in very topical news that Persona 4 Dancing All Night is getting DLC character content of Marie and Adachi.
Interesting. No comment, but interesting.
We also got word a couple weeks ago now, in fact, that GameStop has officially opened the Retro Classics section on its website. You know, there's actually a huge selection of vintage JRPGs available, so this is probably something you're going to want to look into if you're into collecting physical copies of old games. We also have word here that the characters Boruto and Sarada, which of course are some of the children from the new generation of characters in Naruto, are going to be playable characters in the upcoming Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm 4. My understanding is that both of these characters will be DLC characters that will be free with first release copies of the game.
Taiko Drum Master V version is getting three new songs, one each for the category of anime, video games, and vocaloids. And in the video games category is Dr. Wily Stage 1 from Mega Man 2. So definitely worth it if you have a Vita or a Vita TV or PlayStation TV, as they call it over here, and want some Taiko Drum Master fun.
And something worth mentioning about this is that that is going to be free first pressing DLC, very similar to what we were just talking about with that those Naruto characters.
Believe it!
We also have word here that, and this is actually like pretty big news, the Western release of Fire Emblem is going to be called Fire Emblem Fates. But in even bigger news than that, there will be gay marriage in the game. You'll only be able to marry a character of the same sex if they themselves are homo or bisexual. So there's only going to be one male character and one female character. And, you know, the Japanese release of this game, Fire Emblem If, the two different releases, the white and the black one, were named after the respective clan that you would be playing in that game version of the game's storyline. In North America, these are going to be released as Birthright and Conquest. And the Conquest edition is the one that has the gay male character. Bisexual male character.
Who appears to be a pirate.
And he is. He is a pirate indeed. Named Zero, in fact.
Oh, dear. And all the check marks are being ticked for me.
And the Birthright version is the one that will have the lesbian character. So if you're, you know, interested in Fire Emblem, you're interested in gays, both of these things seem pretty likely, considering the show you're listening to, please look forward to it.
In some Dragon Quest news, Yuji Horii-san, the creator of Dragon Quest, has confirmed once again that Dragon Quest XI is going to be a home console game. It will be offline, not an MMO like Dragon Quest X. It'll be a return to the traditional game mechanics of Dragon Quest, and he also mentioned that he's aware that he and Square Enix are aware that fans are clamoring for Dragon Quest 7 and 8 in the West for 3DS, and that the company is, quote, thinking about it, unquote. So that's pretty big news. In Pokken Tournament news, Charizard and Weavile are going to be two of the newest fighters joining the fray, and the game will be out officially on July 16th in Japanese arcades.
Yep, so we are getting closer and closer to that. I'm really excited. I think once we get more information on this game, once it's out in arcades and everyone can play it all the time, I think that this game's hype is going to go up through the roof. I think this is a game that people are going to be very anticipatory for. So I cannot wait to hear more about it. We also have official word from Capcom about when the betas for Street Fighter V will be starting. In North America, you can get guaranteed beta access to Street Fighter V by pre-ordering it via GameStop, Amazon, Best Buy, or just digitally on PSN. And the beta redemption keys will be emailed from the retailer you pre-ordered it from starting on July 20th. Woo! And once you get your key, you can input it immediately into PSN to download the beta client. So,
wow.
If you pre-order digitally, you won't need to redeem the key. You'll just automatically get to download the beta client starting on July 20th.
Nice.
The Silicon Era article that we're going to be linking has instructions for Latin America, the Europe territories, the Asian territories, and we're going to link you to this article over on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org. In some surprise news, Drive Club PlayStation Plus Edition is finally available.
Oh my god.
It's been about a week now that they finally announced it over on the PlayStation blog. It was on Thursday, June 25th, so if you've been waiting for Drive Club PS Plus, then you can download it now.
And wrapping up our follow-ups, we have here some release date updates. First, and best, in my opinion, we have Disgaea 5, Alliance of Vengeance, releasing on the PlayStation 4 on October 6th. We have Steins Gate, releasing on the PlayStation 3 and PS Vita on August 25th. And Dengeki Bunko Fighting Climax will be releasing in Western territories in October.
That's exciting. You know, a lot of people I've seen, well, a lot of our listeners, have been playing JSTAR's Victory Versus. So I'm really excited to see things like that and Dengeki Bunko Fighting Climax making their way over.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a pretty good game. So I actually think Dengeki Bunko Fighting Climax is a better game than JSTAR's Victory Versus. So, you know, but your mileage will vary. Either way, this is going to be a budget release. The PlayStation 3 version will cost $39.99, and the Vita version will cost $29.99. I think that's everything, so let's get on to the news stuff.
News. 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 Oh my god, news.
First up, we have here some news that Jason Schreier from Kotaku tweeted, pointing out that something that we all missed during E3 a couple weeks ago is that the announcement of the Final Fantasy Portal app coming to North America also confirmed that the Triple Triad game will be making its North American mobile debut via the Portal app. So, you know, as someone who plays a lot of Triple Triad, this is very, very exciting news, and it's definitely something that I'm very much looking forward to.
Fans of Steins Gate will be happy to know that Steins Gate Zero, which is actually a sequel, will be coming in November for PS4, PS3, and PS Vita, according to a recent issue of Famitsu.
And that's a Japanese release. We haven't even gotten the first one on the consoles in North America yet, as we were just talking about in our follow-ups.
As we mentioned, or we hinted at last time on GameBuie, Suikoden 3 is now available on PSN. Woo! Play it! In some interesting news regarding the Rise of Mana, is it a mobile social game? I know it's a mobile game, but
Rise of Mana is a mobile game. There are some light social elements, but it's primarily just a mobile game.
So there's going to be a collaboration featuring characters from Final Fantasy Adventure, which is also known as the European version of Mystic Quest, but it's actually, you know, a second Densetsu game. But the interesting thing is that there is a message with the Seiken Densetsu logo at the end saying, production confirmed. So
with the implication is that it's production confirmed of a new Seiken Densetsu game.
Which is exciting.
Yeah, it's super exciting, as long as it's, you know, like a real good game. We also got word that the Yo-Kai Watch anime will be airing in North America on Disney XD. This is going to be starting later this year, and the station currently has rights to the first 26 episodes. But you have to imagine if the show and game blow up the way everyone's hoping, we'll probably be getting a whole lot more than that.
I wonder if we'll see Yo-Kai Watch stuff at Disneyland and Disney parks and such.
I doubt it, but I'd be into it, but I doubt it. Just like they air, like Dragon Ball and stuff, and I've never seen Dragon Ball stuff at Disneyland.
Yeah.
But I'd be into it.
Not to be outdone by Yo-Kai Watch, Pokemon Company.
You can take this one.
Has announced that Pokemon Shuffle is on its way to iOS and Android. And you know what's interesting about this really quickly is that I saw a lot of people saying like, oh, I thought Nintendo said they were going to develop original things for mobile. But the thing is that Pokemon Company is only partially owned by Nintendo. It's also got, you know, Game Freak involved. So Pokemon Company porting games from 3DS to mobile devices doesn't mean that that's what Nintendo is going to do. Just saying.
We also have word here that the indie game phenomenon hit Shovel Knight is going to be getting physical versions for pretty much every platform it's been released on. Wii U, 3DS, PS4, Xbox One are all getting releases in North America retail outlets on October 13th, 2015, in Europe on October 16th, 2015. And the thing that's most exciting about this is that it's going to have a suggested retail price of only
$19.99. Are you out of your mind?
I knew you were going to go there. So this is super exciting. It's going to include the original Shovel Knight game. It's going to have the first content update, the Plague of Shadows scenario, as well as a new full-featured challenge mode. So this is super, super exciting. The digital version is going to get that challenge mode stuff. And the boxed retail version is going to get all of the future updates as they become available for the PC release and digital releases as well. Something else that's really exciting is in the official notice about this, which we'll be linking at over on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
Is that Yacht Club Games gives us a pretty awesome little tease that the Nintendo platforms will be getting exclusive content soon.
Yes!
You know, it's been a point of contention that the Xbox One version has, the Battletoads fight, which is incredible. The PS4 and Vita versions have the Kratos fight, which, you know, are a cool combat, but gives you a new ability in-game if you clear it. So we are going to get something for the game on Nintendo platforms, so just, you know, keep looking forward for that.
Because Pokemon making a mobile social announcement wasn't enough, they had another mobile social announcement to make, and it's actually already out in Japan. This game is called Dance Pokemon Band. It's available for iOS and Android devices in Japan only, and the weird thing is, I shouldn't say weird, something that is different than we're used to hearing is that it will only be downloadable until September 30th, and the app will not be playable after October 29th.
So this screams to me pilot program. This is probably one of those things where, for the sake of protecting the brand, they're doing this as a limited release in case it's not popular. If this is popular, I have no doubt we'll see it up on the store and playable indefinitely. But my thought here is that Pokemon is one of those brands that Nintendo and, you know, the related entities that form Pokemon Company work really hard to protect the brand, keep it strong, don't want it diluted. So I get the feeling that they don't want a Pokemon game to stay on the market if it's not popular. That's what I think this is about. Either way, this is something I expect we'll see in some form in the West, so just keep your eyes peeled for it.
Yep. Fans of Final Fantasy, particularly the Final Fantasy music, particularly the music from Final Fantasy 6, 7, and 10, will be thrilled to know that Square Enix is releasing a Blu-ray disc called Final Symphony, music from Final Fantasy 6, 7, and 10. It will come with a second disc that has MP3 files.
Awesome! The Final Symphony will go on sale in Japan on September 16th for 4,860 yen. So those of you who are looking to import, expect to spend about $50.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the London Symphony Orchestra, which recorded in Abbey Road Studios, so I mean, world class, really.
Yeah, absolutely. We also have huge, huge, huge news here. This is in the form of Keiji Inafune-san's most recent Kickstarter effort. This one is called Red Ash, The Indelible Legend. Those of you, of course, who are terribly clever may notice that Red Ash basically says Redash. And that is because this is going to be a spiritual successor to Rockman Dash, which you might also be familiar with as Mega Man Legends. Inafune-san is being pretty open about the fact that this is a revival of his concepts for Mega Man Legends 3. So if you are one of those of us that was terribly disappointed when Mega Man Legends 3 fell through, this is your chance to see that game get made and play it. I'm already seeing a lot of people really coming after Inafune-san for launching this Kickstarter before Mighty No. 9 is actually released. But for me, Mighty No. 9 at this point, it comes out in, what, like 2 more months? The game is almost certainly finished now, and, you know, they're probably looking for their next project, and they want their next project to be a revival of a game that they felt sore about having been canceled. Inafune-san has been on the record many, many, many times that he was personally very wounded by the cancellation of Mega Man Legends 3. It is not surprising to me that this is their next Kickstarter project. I have already backed it, and if you're someone who is upset about Mega Man Legends 3 not existing, this is your opportunity to make this right.
Indeed. Those who have been clamoring for more Digimon, and that's not me being snarky, are going to be happy to know that Bandai Namco is bringing over Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth to North and South America for PS4 and Vita next year. It is a turn-based role-playing game, and it involves hopping between real-world Japan and the digital world, where I assume that you take the role of a Digi-Destined, if that's still a thing in Digimon lore. It'll include favorite Digimon like Gatomon and whatever the dinosaur one was. I mean, I'm sorry, I was Team Pokemon, but...
Greymon,
yeah. So it actually looks pretty good.
So the reason why this is big news is people were in the West clamoring for a Western release of this game. The storyline is super dark. The combat system is really deep and complex. In fact, the creators of this game were very open about the fact that this is a Digimon game that they made for adult audiences. So it's not like a child RPG. You're not looking at Ni No Kuni here. It's like a beautiful, aww, deep, complex game with a lot of stuff going on and a much darker storyline than you would typically connect to Digimon.
Oh, you mean a dark, gritty, monster battling JRPG in 1080p, 60fps? Basically what people want for Pokemon since forever?
Pretty much! We also, and this is big news...
Hey, Pokemon fans, enjoy Dance Pokemon Band!
You're unkind. Announced this weekend at Anime Expo in Los Angeles, was Zero Escape Volume 3.
Yeah.
This is going to be a summer 2016 release for 3DS and Vita, and Western localization versions are being produced simultaneously with the Japanese version. Because, for reasons that are very confusing to me, the Zero Escape series is as popular in North America as it is in Japan. Which, you know, for a series of murder mystery visual novels is kind of surprising. You might be familiar with this from 999 and, what was the other one, Virtue's Last Reward?
Yeah, where the Kickstarter rewards, or not Kickstarter, the pre-order bonuses were very dramatically out of stock or something.
Yeah, well, these are big deals, these two games. And the third is also going to be a big deal. And this is just super exciting news. Super, super, super exciting. So please look forward to it.
Captain Spike, were you just talking about murder mystery visual novels?
Yeah, yeah.
That seems like a very specific genre because, at Anime Expo as well, Manga Gamer has announced that they're working on a Steam version of the murder mystery visual novel, Umineko, When They Cry.
I think When They Cry is already available on Steam. Maybe not, but either way, there is an English language version of When They Cry available already. This is going to have an all-new translation, though.
That's usually a good thing. When you see that things have a new translation, it's probably for a reason. This man are sick.
Yeah, absolutely. We also have word here that Arc System Works is going to be bringing their cult classic 2.5D fighting game, Battle Fantasia Revised Edition, to Steam. This is going to be available this week, in fact, on July 7th. And downloading the game off of Steam will land you a free digital copy of the game's soundtrack, which is actually kind of exciting because this game had a cool soundtrack, as I recall. All of the Arc System Works games do, though. We also have word here that the PC visual novel remake of Himawari the Sunflower will be releasing in North America on Steam.
This is the all-ages version.
This is the all-ages version, and that's why I was stumbling there for a minute. The Manga Gamers website will be selling an uncensored version, which if you buy, you will also get the all-ages version on Steam. My understanding of this game, because this was actually a fairly very popular, like, hard sci-fi visual novel with strong romance elements. If you're just interested in the sci-fi stuff, I highly recommend you check out the all-ages version. My understanding is that for Western sensibilities, the adult version can actually be a little too skeevy, but that the core storyline is really good. I'm not super familiar with it myself. I will be playing the all-ages version, and you'll probably hear about it on this show in a few months.
Lovely.
Awesome. We also, last and kind of least, have word that Square Enix is suspending sales of the Mac client of Final Fantasy XIV and even offering full refunds to consumers who bought it and are disappointed. The TLDR on this one is that due to the fact that Square Enix's Final Fantasy XIV team was being stretched kind of thin due to the release of Heaven's Word, there was some miscommunications, and basically the Mac client for Final Fantasy XIV has vastly lower system requirements than what it actually needs. So people were running this game, and people with like super high-end Macs were having no problem with it. But people with like last year's model were basically finding an unplayable slideshow. And people on like older Mac laptops were who thought they had, you know, the more powerful enough systems to run the game, were finding it running.
Wait, my MacBook Air can't run it.
Ah, right. Like they were just, it was completely unplayable. So either way, Square Enix is going back to the drawing board on that, trying to get it further optimized and get correct system requirements out there. And in the meantime, they're no longer selling the game, and they are refunding anyone who bought it and was unhappy. To me, this is a class act on how you really fix this, on how you solve a problem like this, how you get in front of it and take care of it. And that, to me, is really sort of the whole byline of Final Fantasy XIV post-A Realm Reborn. I feel like this whole Final Fantasy XIV saga IRL is basically Square Enix realizing they done fucked up and fixing it correctly. So, good on Square Enix. It's hard for me to hold this against them. They made a mistake, but they're fixing it. I'd like to see other PC developers take a cue here.
Or some other companies who need to get their act together, because we have some
doom and gloom.
Here's some vile news. Are you too sad to speak of this, Captain Spike, or can you deal with it?
Oh, man. So, basically, the TLDR here is that Xbox Marketing League Aaron Greenberg was on the Gamertag radio podcast, and when asked about the Phantom Dust project, he basically openly acknowledged, we don't have an active developer on that right now. He talked about how, you know, it's been a passion project for Phil Spector and a lot of other people internally on the Xbox team. They are still exploring the project because they do want to do something with Phantom Dust. It isn't canceled, but they just, right now, things aren't moving forward.
Wait, did you say it's a passion project for Phil Spector?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Spencer.
Phil, I was going to say, like, is he doing like a Wall of Sound soundtrack for Phantom Dust?
Look, you can say all of the things that Phil Spector deserves to have said about him. That would be awesome. I mean, just
hey,
vacuum removed from reality, that would be awesome.
I love the stuff that he did, you know, with those early '60s girl groups and George Harrison and. I even like his arrangements on Let It Be, but this isn't Music Buoy.
Indeed. In other super sad news, super sad to me, probably not to, you know, most people, the KOF World Facebook, this is the official Facebook for all things King of Fighters,
but never too seriously,
announced on June 30th that the Rhythm of Fighters for iOS and Android is no longer going to be supported as of July 15th. In fact, they're even going to be removing the program from the app stores. So if you've bought it previously, you need to download it before July 15th in order to keep it on your device. You know, this is another one of those, like we were just talking about a few weeks ago when we were talking about derezzed games. This is one that to me is a loss because, as I said here on the show, I downloaded this game on a whim once and was really blown away by how fun it was. So to hear that it's going to stop existing effectively is just really sad to me, and I just am actually really disappointed to see that this game is going to be going away. Slaggy, anything to say about that?
Nope, but there are some things to talk about that are...
controversial.
Oh my god.
So, first of all, Yu Suzuki has come under fire for the development of Shenmue 3 being a Kickstarter project. Of course, you know, all of these Kickstarters are under fire now. My personal standpoint and perspective remains that these games that we have been clamoring for 10, 15, 20 years that we're suddenly seeing revived via Kickstarter, I'm seeing a lot of people like, well, I don't want to give them a free loan. If this game was going to get made, it was going to get made whether it was Kickstartered or not. Well, I mean, I appreciate that perspective. But, like, if Sony planned on funding Shenmue, we would probably already have it. I mean, real talk here, people have been clamoring for Shenmue for Shenmue 3 for the last 15 years nearly. We don't have it yet. Do you really think this would be getting made without crowdfunding?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel the same way, you know, I feel the same way about Red Ash. Like, it's cool if people want to jump on and say, oh, I'm sure someone would want to publish this and fund it now that, you know, Mighty No. 9 had such success on Kickstarter. Like, I appreciate that that's your opinion, but I don't think it's accurate to the reality of the fact that if they could fund it that way, they probably would be.
Notice how Capcom has done nothing.
Right? Well, we're getting
some
ports of Mega Man 1 through 6.
Inafune-san was like, I will reskin Mighty No. 9 as a Mega Man game if you are willing to work with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't think the world works the way that some of these people think it does. Are people maybe being too egregious? Are they taking advantage a little? Maybe. But I would much rather have these revivals happening. I want to live in a world with Shenmue 3. I want to live in a world with the spiritual successor to Mega Man Legends 3. I want to live in a world with fucking Bloodstained. If Kickstarter and buying games 2 years before they come out is what that takes, I would rather that than being stuck in a never-ending AAA shit show that I thought we were heading toward 5 years ago. So, basically, back on topic, Yu Suzuki has talked about how basically, you know, Sony's going to be helping primarily just with publishing. They're not really funding the development of the game. That is primarily coming from the Kickstarter fans. That's why the game, you know, has stretch goals up to like 10 million, which is like a full open world like Shenmue 1 and 2. And, you know, basically, Yu Suzuki is saying, we want to make a game that finishes the story first and foremost. All of these additional game systems come after. We're hoping to do that too. But Sony is not just funding this game. So I appreciate people who aren't feeling it. As always, do not buy something you don't want. Do not, you know, kickstart something that you don't, you know, trust in and have faith in. But don't begrudge these games getting made this way when they clearly weren't getting made before. That's my take on it. Slaggy, what about you?
I agree. Like I said, you know, I mean, sorry, like you said, if Sony was going to money hat this, they would have money hatted it. It's, well, I guess they're only money-hatting part of it, you know, so like...
Well, I mean, we are getting a PC release, so, and to me, that's way better than a PS4 release. So, to me, you know, if Sony were funding it, we probably wouldn't be getting that PC release. Then, ultimately, don't we want more people to be able to play the game? Like, isn't that ideal?
Yeah.
We also have here an opinion piece by Ben Kuchera on Polygon, which probably seems like I'm now fishing for hits. But, you know, this is a sort of response piece to Anita Sarkeesian's tweets that we talked about very briefly last episode. You know, I had asked you, Slaggy, if you had seen her tweets about how she was disappointed that E3 was opening on, like, a celebration of, like, dude bro violence.
Yeah, and Bethesda's taking a lot of hits right now. Fallout Shelter is getting a lot of criticism about the pregnancy mechanics and such.
And I don't really have a lot to say about pregnancy mechanics, because that's been a thing, I mean, in, you know, Japanese role-playing games, like, Conception, even to some degree, Fire Emblem Awakening had elements like that. So I'm not really going to get too much on that, but I am going to say that basically Bethesda's official response when asked on camera, this was Pete Hines, who's a higher up there, when Polygon asked him, like, hey, how do you feel about criticism of your violence, of the violence in your games? He literally just shrugged. His feelings were that, you know, if people don't like this, they shouldn't play it. And I actually agree with that. You know, I do, and I hope I said this last week. If I didn't, I apologize. I do think it's very important that people talk about this violent content. I don't see why things just go unquestioned. Like, it's okay for Doom to be hyper-violent. It's Doom. Like, maybe have a better explanation than that. But, at the same time, if the explanation is, you know, we wanted to make a hyper-violent Doom game, we thought that, you know, the more focus on, like, stealth and survival of Doom 3 was a letdown, and we want to get back to basics, well, all right, you know, do you. People who aren't into it, that's cool, too. But people should be able to talk about this, and that's my big problem, is a lot of people were jumping on Anita Sarkeesian's case, like, you know, oh, she should just shut up and talk about feminism and not violence in games. But to me, like, why not have a dialogue? Why not think critically?
Oh, especially since so much about agree with feminism in games is tied to violence in games.
Well, right, but at the same time, you know, if you don't agree, as ever and always, rather than being a little shit about it, make a video, make a vlog detailing your points. Be a respectable gentleman or gentlewoman. But, you know, it's okay to have your own opinion. It's okay to do your own research and find that you disagree with other people, even experts. You may not have a fancy diploma by your name. You may not have a doctorate or whatever. That does not mean your opinion is invalid. It does not mean you need to resort to tweeting at people, oh, I wish you were dead because I don't like your opinion. No, just state your opinion. Form an opinion. Form a reasoned argument and then make it. And let's all enjoy the fact that we can communicate about art and ultimately have, you know, a good dialogue about these things. That's my problem. That's why, to me, this is so controversial, because we're seeing so many people leaping to Bethesda's side on this specific issue. Like, oh, you really told them, shrug. Like, no, dude. Like, I don't really think that's a great answer. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but, you know, maybe have a little bit more to say than shrug. Just my thought. Slaggy?
Yeah, I mean, like, he did follow up, you know, with talking about how he even told his own son to, like, not watch the Doom part of the conference. So, you know, I think the whole discussion surrounding violence in games, like you said, is a very complex issue. It's one that I'm sure we'll probably have one day on the show, but, you know, I don't really have anything to add. You summed it up pretty well.
All right. We also, of course, have word here that iTunes reject the recent submission, Kill the Plumber, which is, you know, like a takeoff on Mario, but you're controlling villains and trying to kill Mario.
Which is actually a really fun little concept.
Yeah, right? The funny thing to me, of course, is that people are, you know, celebrating, like, oh, that it's a good thing, because this game was rejected to defend Nintendo's copyright on Mario. But the thing is, it actually doesn't utilize any assets from Mario, even if it does have assets that are somewhat similar to them. I actually don't think this is super appropriate of Apple. I think that while reminiscent of Mario, there's nothing there that's actually infringing. Like, this is actually really surprising to me.
I mean, it's very much, you know, parody, but parody.
Well, exactly. I just, like, looking at it, it's like there are no assets here from Mario. It's just kind of suggestive of Mario, which to me, like, this is less infringy than something like
Crossy Road?
Super Gianna Sisters or something.
Oh, okay.
I mean, certainly you could look at Crossy Road, which was the derivative of Frogger, and that was, you know, recent, you know, is available as
then,
far as
you know,
I know.
Flappy Bird gets pulled into this discussion because Flappy Bird actually using assets from the game.
Well, exactly. So, I think this one is wrong. I think there's something weird going on here.
I think the thing that is the shame is that the game concept is actually really clever. It looks like a lot of love and work was put into this, and it's not just some shitty clone, which I, as far as I know, aren't too bad on the iOS store, but I know that they're all over the Google Play store.
Yeah. All right, well, and last, but certainly not least, we have here that Apple recently removed all American Civil War-based games from the App Store due to the presence of the Confederate flag. Now, if you're a local native to America, you probably understand why this is a touchy issue right now.
Oh, I'm sure that our listeners in other countries have been laughing at America about that as well.
Hopefully not laughing, but yeah, I mean, they're probably aware of it.
No, laughing like at the people who are like, really, you were flying that, really?
Oh, okay, yeah, dude, right? So it's interesting that they're removing games in which this flag is, you know, an actual historical element. I certainly do think that removing things that use the Confederate flag in terms of, like, being offensive or mean-spirited, like, yeah, I do agree with that. But things where it's being used as, like, historical reference, like, I don't know if I think that's appropriate. That, to me, almost actually screams of, like, censorship, honestly. Like, I don't use that term super, super loosely. It's just,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're making a Civil War game and you want to be accurate to history, you kind of need the Confederate flag. And I'm not, like, defending the Confederate flag. I don't think the Confederate flag is an okay thing in 2015 to be flying. Like, no, that is awful. How effing dare you?
Right, but, and, you know, one of the developers of Ultimate General Gettysburg, one of the games that was affected, was saying that, you know, you could buy or rent Gettysburg the Movie or Schindler's List on iTunes. So, I mean, like, you know, just kind of saying that, you know, as a game, it's, you know, it's almost like unfairly being targeted. And as this story has developed, Apple has realized, oh, they kind of, like, were too heavy-handed and they're working with developers. But Apple being heavy-handed with these games things has been really kind of something that's been happening lately.
Well, and this to me sort of touches on what I was saying about how we need to be able to have a dialogue about violence in games. Like an actual dialogue, not just some people saying games shouldn't be violent and some other people saying games should be whatever they want. And ultimately I do come down on the side that games should be whatever they want. But I think we should all be talking about what these things mean. And I think that because I think it's important for the growth of games as an art form. And where this connects to my feelings here are, again, that we're seeing Apple censoring what I feel is censoring these games primarily because games aren't viewed as a respected art form the way that, you know, films are. You know, as Slaggy was saying, you know, Maxim Zasov of Game Labs was saying, you know, that you can rent Schindler's List, you can buy Gettysburg on iTunes, but games are just getting pushed aside. Because, again, Apple can be heavy-handed with games in ways that if they ever were with movies and music, they would be, I don't want to say crucified, because this is such a sensitive topic, I shouldn't be so crass and easy, loose-lipped with terms like that, but they'd be fucking crucified. I mean, really, but because it's just games, they're not real art, they get away with it. And I don't agree with that. And I think that it's really important that so many people are taking Apple to task on this Confederate flag thing, even though I do agree with the spirit of what they're doing. I cannot make that clear enough. Slaggy, do you have anything to add?
Nope.
All right, well then, let's get down to this discussion. So we're here tonight to talk about everybody's favorite Shin Megami Tensei spinoff, Devil Kids.
But wait, my favorite Shin Megami Tensei spinoff is Jack Rose. Oh, wait, that's my favorite something else.
Girl, something else. We all know you talk about gay porn. So,
So Persona.
Persona, that's what we're actually talking about, yeah. The Persona series has its roots in the Shin Megami Tensei series, of course. But what a lot of people don't realize is that it was sort of rooted in the 1994 Super Famicom release, Shin Megami Tensei IF. You know, this was actually, it's like a proto-Persona almost. The player chooses a male or female high school student to control, and is basically sucked into another realm of the realm of demons, and really has to arm himself using gear from straight up like a locker in his school, in order to, you know, start making deals with demons and get them to fight you while, you know, combating the personification of five of the seven deadly sins. It's very much connected to the Persona series, even going so far as in Persona 2 Eternal Punishment, the female player character actually appears as a character in Eternal Punishment. In that game, she has the name Tamaki Uchida-san. She is a character that you can name yourself in if you ever play it. There are fan-translated versions of If. You can get them online pretty easily. For emulators, unfortunately, it's never officially released in North America. If you have Japanese consoles and you're comfortable playing a game like this in Japanese, it was released on the Japanese Virtual Console for Wii on February 1st, 2011, and it was released on the Wii U Virtual Console in Japan on October 16th, 2013. So it was a fairly early Virtual Console release in Japan. Slaggy, I assume you haven't played that one?
I've never played it, but I think it's an interesting little piece of history that a lot of people may not realize.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I've played one of the fan translations, which, you know, I love the fact that we live in a world where that's a thing. Like, I think that's really cool. So, obviously, this conversation really starts properly with the first Persona game. Released originally in North America as Revelations Persona. You may recall that for a hot minute, Atlus was trying to make Shin Megami Tensei, like, happen in North America under the branding Revelations. They even released an anime spinoff, Tokyo Revelations, it was called in North America. It's good stuff. Anyway, this is really the start of Persona, and it actually has a really interesting history. Slaggy, do you remember the way this game was censored for its North American release? Or,
yeah,
let's say, adapted?
Yeah, they really tried to, you know, Americanize it. To the point where, you know, the thing that, if you're familiar with Persona games, is that there are a lot of elements that are very much like Japanese school life. And, you know, I think that at first, especially with Atlus really trying to make Revelations happen, they were really concerned about how this would be received, you know, back in 1996, which I guess makes, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. You know, anime was still very kind of under the radar, but most definitely shouldn't have been. And so they, you know, really tried to Americanize it to the point where one of the characters who's just Japanese in the original release was changed to an African-American man, or, you know, young man, in the American version. Not that I'm saying that, you know, including persons of color is a bad thing. It was just really interesting that, you know, they went to that, it's just really interesting that they went to that level to try and basically remove a lot of the Japanese elements.
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely did. They really did try to make it into, like, a Western game. Something else that was interesting about this, some of you may recall, is that they actually also, like, chopped off, like, a whole third of the story for this game in its North American release. My understanding is that it wasn't really, like, that it was, like, a problem with the content. This was the Snow Queen story, but it was really more just, like, an issue of, like, it was kind of mature, and they didn't really have the time and budget to, like, really get the whole game, like, finished up and polished up for release. So they just cut off the part that they felt would be most easy to remove from the game. So they just basically made it so that you can't enter that storyline. You can talk to some of the NPCs for it, but you can't actually do that storyline. Which, you know, as such things go, it is certainly not as bad as you could get from a series that's all about, you know, tarot cards and demons and making deals. This game plays more like an old-school JRPG. It actually has, like, a really cool, very slick style to it. At the time, I mean, you know, by today's age, it certainly looks dated, but it uses, like, an isometric overhead view for the combat, which I always thought was cool. You know, the dungeons and building navigation are in the first person, which is normal for the Shin Megami Tensei series at this point in time. Battles were triggered either by story events or random encounters, very similar to what you would expect from a JRPG of the era. What made it most interesting for people was that you had the ability to talk to the enemy. And, you know, this is very similar to Shin Megami Tensei. It's very similar to, you know, some of the other Persona games where you can really talk to enemies and try to recruit them. We already saw the customizations of Personas and assignment of Personas being done in the Velvet Room with Igor. This is sort of a leitmotif for the series that is, I think, been present in all of them. Saigi, is that
true? As far as I know, I mean, like you said, and, you know, here is where I'm going to kind of jump in and say that, you know, it does show its age a lot, especially if you have played the later Persona games and then go back to try and play the first Persona. But it's really, you know, you really need to appreciate that so many of the elements that make Persona what it is really, you know, were evident in this very first game.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that while I was doing research, I was revisiting some of these games. Because in some cases, I haven't played these games in, you know, 10 years. So when revisiting them for this episode, I was really taken aback. Like, in a lot of ways, while things have changed, in another way, like, the settings, the tropes,
the butterflies,
standards, like, they were already in place 10 years ago, 20, well, 15 years ago.
No, almost 20.
Almost 20. Holy cats. Of course, we say almost 20 because this game released in Japan on September 20th, 1996, and in North America in December of 1996. It also got a Japanese PC release on March 25th, 1999, and its most recent release came on the PlayStation Portable platform. This was a remake of sorts. It used the same assets, as I recall, but brought the game up to, like, you know, the widescreen perspective. The widescreen aspect ratio of the PlayStation Portable. For the stuff that was cut out from the North American release, characters that were changed and stuff, they were reverted to their original forms. Storyline was, you know, retranslated. So that was actually, I thought, very cool. And that came out in Japan April 29th, 2009. North America, September 22nd, 2009. And in the EU territories on August 11th, 2010.
Now, Captain Spike, did you play Persona, Revelations Persona, back in 1996?
I did. I still have my disc copy of this.
Wow. And how was it received at the time?
So, I read about it in probably Die Hard Game Fan or something. I really liked it. It was almost like a dirty secret. You know, like some games, you know, I would play with no problem. My parents would see all kinds of blood and gore, whatever. It was not a thing. But there was something really subversive about the religious overtones of this game.
Oh, yeah.
That actually, in my family, were actually kind of problematic. And so, for me, this was almost like a dirty little secret that, like, I totally used the money I got to buy this game that my parents would not approve of. And it was, you know, it was very dark. That was what stuck with me, was that it was probably the darkest game I had played to that point. I really enjoyed it, though, and I remember reading, again, bringing this back, reading in magazines that it was too much for a lot of people, and I would try to talk about it to classmates and stuff, and they would, like, try to find it at Blockbuster and stuff, and, like, it was hard to find, and people seemed to be, like, very off-put by this game. So,
it's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting, I felt, and still do feel looking back. But I remember it got a great response from critics at the time. That's why I was super looking into it. Like, I was super excited. And I'm just happy that the Persona series really took off the way it did. What was your first experience with this game?
My first experience was on the PSP after the release of, you know, by that point, Persona 4 had been out, Persona 4 Golden. So I definitely had the perspective of, you know, coming in later in the series, and then, you know, so I definitely appreciated it from a historical perspective, but like I said, you know, it might just be because the later games in the Persona series are so iconic and so well done that, you know, these games just kind of, I don't know, it's a really interesting phenomenon, you know, when you go back and play games that come earlier in a series, you know. Sometimes they're like, oh, this is really good. But, you know, I'm not saying that it's a bad game. I'm just saying that I didn't get as much out of it, aside from more of a historical appreciation, which, you know, is, you know, I think that's still valuable.
Thank you for being honest there. I think it would have been really easy to just, oh, it was great, it was super good. But no, I appreciate that you said that. You know, it does show its age. I think it probably is probably a bit of a rough spot now playing it, and, you know, knowing about how the Persona series grows and about how JRPGs in general have really changed in their approach to game design. So I do think Persona's probably a tough one to get into now. But if you are, it is pretty easy to get. It is available digitally on the PlayStation Store.
Yep.
So if you have, like, a Vita or something, you could hop in on this one super easy. Moving forward, and we're going to talk about these two games in one. Moving forward, we have Persona 2. And something that was really interesting and pretty neat about Persona 2 is that it's actually, like, two separate games that have a connected storyline.
Yeah.
So that is Persona 2 Innocent Sin and Persona 2 Eternal Punishment. Now, originally in North America, we only got the release, and this is actually kind of funny. Originally in North America, we only got Eternal Punishment. We did not get Innocent Sin. These games were remade for the PSP, some number of years later, and we only got Innocent Sin. We did not get Eternal Punishment.
Oh,
so
that's
they really
right.
Flip-flopped there. The reasoning for that is that, unfortunately, in North America, Atlas didn't feel like they could recoup the costs of translating the remake for a PSP North American release.
Right.
Fortunately, because Eternal Punishment was translated into English, and the translation was done more authentically and seriously than the Persona 1 localization, they did re-release that version on the PSN store as a PS1 classic, and it is still perfectly playable. Doesn't feel quite as crisp and fresh as the PSP remake of Innocent Sin, but it's still absolutely playable. This is another one that is, very, very much, a classic-style JRPG. Still, all of the stuff that I liked about the first Persona game still applies here. There was some added stuff in terms of, like, the rumor system, it was called, where if you heard about a rumor from an NPC, you could, like, spread it, which would change the world around the characters and, like, create, like, in-battle and in, like, world map, like, effects, which was really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It was just a really neat game with a lot of really fresh and cool ideas about JRPGs. Persona 2 Innocent Sin released in Japan on the PS1 on June of 1999. The PSP remake came out in 2011 in April in Japan. North America came out in September of the same year. And in the EU territories, came out in November of the same year. So no more of that, like, six-month wait, a nine-month wait BS. Eternal Punishment released on the PlayStation in 2000, in June for Japan and December for North America. The PSP remake came out in Japan in May of 2012. And the PSN release in North America of the PS1 version was in February of 2013. Slaggy, have you played either of these games?
I've played very little of Innocent Sin.
The original or the remake?
The remake for PSP. And I can't speak too much to it because I haven't spent enough time with it, but it really struck me just upon first blush that it seemed much darker, like, in a big way from the first Persona. Which, you know, there's definitely some dark themes, and I mean, Shin Megami Tensei, demons, lol, but, you know, I almost want to say it struck me as a more adult game, not, like, adult X-rated.
Not eroge, just a more mature experience.
Yeah, but, you know, the PSP remake seems really great, you know, it looks very polished, and I'd like to spend more time with it, but, you know, there's other Persona games that are currently on my radar right now, so...
Excellent, excellent. Well, you definitely should do that, because they're both really cool games, I think. You know, certainly they're probably a little tougher to get into than the Persona 3 and 4, which we'll be talking about pretty shortly. Innocent Sin, in particular, does have an absolutely batshit storyline involving rumor-generated Nazis.
Oh, wow.
Which are led by a resurrected Hitler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because, again, you know, they're in this setting where people's wishes come true and someone wished for Nazis and Hitler. It's a whole thing. The game is, it's super Lovecraftian. There's one really cool thing is that in, there is a relationship system in this game. Obviously not quite to the same degree as the social links as we think about them in Persona 3 and Persona 4 and hopefully Persona 5.
Oh, dear God, I hope so.
But there is a relationship system, and there was actually a same-sex relationship in the game.
Really?
Which was actually done very specifically by the team to find out really how the audience would feel about a same-sex relationship.
I never realized that because, you know, when we talk about Persona 4, and we've talked about Persona 4 before as well, but, we really think about that and the themes of sexuality and gender and stuff. So I didn't realize that Persona 2 had set that precedent.
Yes, they had. Like, a very intentional precedent to set. So I think that that is just super cool. I think it's really neat. And to me, makes the game almost more interesting in the modern age. So, definitely I would recommend you check out Innocent Sin, at least. That PSP remake is super solid. Persona 2, this one I did play contemporaneous to its PS1 release. It's really cool. It's a little bit strange because I felt like I was missing something from the story. I had already known about the Innocent Sin thing because, again, you know, the gaming mags that I was reading were talking about these things. It wasn't just like I was a Nintendo Power reader, like, how come Mario 3 isn't out yet, but I know people who have played it? Games don't come from Japan. Like, no, I knew about this. And
LOL.
Like, I knew I was only getting half the story, and maybe it made me see things that weren't even there, because I know other people who felt like Eternal Punishment told a complete story, and I just did not at all. I felt like it was a mess, I was super unhappy. I didn't really make my peace with Eternal Punishment until... I would say in the last 3 or 4 years. Now I think it's a great game. Now I think it's like, oh yeah, this is awesome. But contemporaneous, I was super stoked for this game. And then, like, almost immediately within the first half hour, it was referencing event. I felt like it was referencing events from a game I didn't even know. And I was just getting very frustrated with it. So, that to me is actually something that, looking back, it's like, man, I hated this game. Like, I had a problem with this game. Slaggy, have you played Eternal Punishment at all?
I have not, and I'm curious about other people's experience, both, you know, mostly contemporaneously, because now you can play them both, but did that, like, affect, did that make Atlas be like, oh, we've got to be more careful?
Yeah, that's interesting question to ask. Anyway, I don't want to talk about Persona 2 too much more. If you're going to play one of the classic Personas, Persona 2 might be the way to go. But we'll talk about that a little more toward the end of this program. Let's get on to the game that I think Slaggy could actually really do a lot of the talking. Slaggy, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Persona 3?
Well, Persona 3 is really where the series as we know it has really started to take shape. It's like the others, stars a high school student, you know, kind of investigating mysterious things, there's demons, but a lot of the elements that we really think of as Persona, especially if Persona 4 was the first one that you played, are present in this game. There is, most notably, the social links, which really started to bring in, you know, almost like a visual novel dating sim sort of element, which is, to me, like... When I played Persona 4 for the first time, that was my first Persona. That was really one of the elements that I found really fun. And so, in a lot of ways, Persona 3 and Persona 4 have many similarities in that regard. I even feel like some, you know, the character development was a lot stronger, maybe because of the social links. Or, I mean, I don't know, like, but I felt like, you know, the characters in Persona 3, I felt like, were a lot more memorable. And it might be just because I spent more time with it, but, I really feel like this is where, you know, the Persona team at Atlas really started to hit their stride.
Well, and, you know, something about Persona 3 that we really need to talk about if we're going to talk about Persona 3 is that there are three versions of this game.
There are.
There are the original release, Shin Megami Tensei Persona 3, but there's also Persona 3 FES, which is a expansion to the game. Now, it features the complete original game, but it also includes an all-new epilogue, which is, you know, actually a big deal because the epilogue is it's a long thing. Like, you think, oh, an epilogue, you think it's just going to be short, but the epilogue, The Answer, it's like a whole, like, 10 to 15 hour expansion, as I recall. Like, it's wow. like a whole little scenario. And it takes place immediately
and
following
just think,
the cliff, well, not quite cliffhanger ending, but it feels like a cliffhanger after you've played The Answer.
Just think, there are AAA games coming out right now that, complete with all of the DLC that comes out with it, is not even a 15 hour game.
Ah, right. But then there was also Persona 3 Portable, which is an enhanced remake of the first version of Persona 3
Portable is really interesting.
For the PlayStation Portable. Now, there are a couple of things that are really controversial about Persona 3 Portable. But the first one is that you actually have a selectable alternate playable character in Persona 3 Portable, where you can play either as the original male character, or you can actually play as a female character. And this selection actually alters a lot of stuff in-game. Igor will have a different assistant in the Velvet Room. Social Link stories play out completely differently. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, like, kind of a big deal. Interestingly, though, Persona 3 Fez, all of the new content from Fez is not present in Persona 3 Portable, nor is The Answer content.
Mm.
The battle system was revised, though, to add in elements from Persona 4, which is very cool. Originally, Persona 3 only had, AI control for the non-protagonist player characters in combat, but that is turned into, for Persona 3 Portable, a toggle, similar to Persona 4, so you can control your characters if you choose to do so. I think there's one particularly controversial design choice that I've heard you talk about a lot, even in the last week.
Yeah, that, one of the things that if you played Persona 4 and that's your only experience, you're probably thinking about, walking around, making my way downtown, walking fast, paces fast, and I'm homebound. Sorry, I had to. But, walking around at school, walking around at town, even, walking, down at the little park area or by the river or whatever. But all of the kind of overworld stuff, if you want to call it that, was more like a point and click, like a classic adventure game sort of thing. So it's very, I don't know. I mean, it does make it feel like a very different game, but I guess that just depends on what you really consider to be the core of the Persona series. You're able to, go through, it was Tartarus in this, right? Was the hellish realm that existed in your high school or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
So, you're still doing, the dungeon crawling, which is, a huge part of the series, but it makes it for a very different type of experience because, I have to say I prefer the more traditional Persona experience where you get to walk around and be the character, but it's interesting. I think it was, a interesting choice, an interesting gamble, I guess you could say, for them to make for a portable console.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to play counter, I vastly prefer Persona 3 Portable as an experience, which is why I get so uptight about the fact that the Answer content isn't available in it. I play a lot of my games on the go. I've talked about that here on the show quite a bit over the years. So to me, having the sort of, you say visual novel, and you're not exactly wrong, like the point and click style interface interaction with the world, it just makes things go faster for me. I don't really connect necessarily with it's so immersive, I'm taking control of this character, in order to go to his bedroom, I'm going to have to enter this building, load screen, go through the living room, load screen, go up the stairs, load screen, go to his room, load screen. I guess I just feel like the game flow is so much tighter and faster paced with the point-and-click style of exploration, and I appreciate that there's no real exploration in that mode.
Right.
But for me, for the kind of gamer I am, it just feels more intuitive, it moves faster, it really cuts down on sort of the slow lag time.
Do you wish that the Persona series after that point took from that?
I'll be honest, I was disappointed that Persona 4 Golden didn't make that change.
Mm-hmm.
I was disappointed. even though, to be fair to Persona 4, a lot more of the storytelling in Persona 4 happens in those third-person 3D areas than did in Persona 3, I feel.
Mm.
It's hard to imagine something like, you know, that first experience where everyone falls into the TV that's in the store. Is that Brosuke's family store?
Yeah, Juness.
Yeah, Juness. You know, it's hard to imagine that that scene would have quite the same impact if it were done as a point-and-click style. So, I mean, I guess there's room for both styles of game, mm-hmm. in my opinion. But I definitely personally feel like Persona 3 is best experienced that way. I think it's a faster, snappier experience, and for me, it's more intuitive and more fun. Anyway, Persona 3 originally launched on the PlayStation 2. In Japan, it released on July 13th, 2006. North America was August 14th, 2007. The EU territories were February 29th, 2008. And the Australian release was March 6th, 2008.
Yeah, so pretty late in the PS2's life.
Well, that's not all. Fez released in Japan on April 19th, 2007. In North America, April 22nd, 2008. In the EU territories, October 17th, 2008. And in Australia on November 13th, 2008. Something really cool about this is that Fez is available as a PS2 classic on PSN in North America and the EU territories. It released in North America on PSN on April 10th, 2012, and in the EU territories February 12th, 2014. The portable version on PlayStation Portable released in Japan November 1st, 2009, North America July 6th, 2010, and in the EU territories April 28th, 2011. The Fez version and the portable version are both still very easy to get on PSN. They go on sale a lot.
They were just on sale, if you noticed our social media. We shared that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. The Atlas, both on the PlayStation Network and the Nintendo eShop for other games in the Persona family. You know, this stuff goes on sale pretty frequently. So if you're interested in getting into Persona, this might be the way to go, is some of these PSN options.
Yeah.
Saigi, now Persona 3 is one that, as I understand, you've actually spent a lot of time with.
Yeah, I haven't finished it by any means, but, you know, definitely... Are we going to talk about the jumping in point at the end?
Yes, we will.
Yeah, but I mean, I definitely think that it contains a lot of what I like about Persona, you know, and that's hard to... you can't fault the earlier games for that, but, you know, I think the experience is enhanced with the social links, and, you know, I prefer playing it... I prefer Fez over Portable, but they're both... you can't go wrong with either experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that was initially, at least, controversial about Persona 3 is that when you summon your persona, you hold a gun to your head, effectively. You have the summoning devices.
The evokers
that you hold up to your head as if a gun and summon your persona by psychically blowing your brains out, effectively. This is something that was very controversial at the time, and I feel like if it released now, it would be super controversial.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was really, in a lot of ways, as Slaggy was saying, you know, the core of what we think of as Persona now really gelled here. The Persona 3 storyline continues non-canonically in the Persona 3 anime, Persona Trinity Soul, which is actually fairly popular, but the storyline also continues in Persona 4 Arena, Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, and Persona Q, all of which we'll be talking about a little later, but just want to make that note here.
Well, I didn't realize that the Arena games continued with 3.
Yeah, so the Arena games actually have several playable characters from Persona 3, and they do have storylines in the game.
And I mean, I did know that... is it Yukiko who makes a cameo in Persona 3 Portable? I think maybe Portable.
I believe so. Yes.
And the main character from Catherine, I think, as well.
Yeah, Vincent.
Yes.
And I have to say, you know, I love Vincent, and it actually looks like he may be appearing in Persona 5 as well.
Ooh.
But yeah, so I love Persona 3. I think the story is not as tight as Persona 4's. We're going to get to that in a minute. But again, you know, the social links really brought out the character development, like you were saying, Slaggy. And to me, Persona 3 really was the first JRPG in many, many years where I really felt a strong bond to these characters. And I don't think it's coincidental that this was really the start of the focus on social links.
Mm-hmm.
Really, as you're, you know, getting to know all these different characters and watching them interact in a really stupid way, like, you really do kind of bond with them. So, do you have anything else to say, Slaggy?
Nope.
Okay. Then let's talk a little bit about Persona 4. Persona 4 is somehow, I will never understand this, Persona 4 is effing huge. Everybody effing loves Persona 4.
For good reason.
If you're listening to this episode, you probably love Persona 4. So, Slaggy, why don't you get us started talking about Persona 4?
Well, it was released for the PS2 on July 10th, 2008 in Japan, December 8th, 2008 in North America, March 12th in Australia in 2009, March 13th in the European regions in 2009, and then received a PSN release in North America on April 8th, 2014. In the enhanced version, plays P4 Golden came out in 2012 on June 14th in Japan, North America on November 20th, Australia on February 21st, 2013, and Europe a day later. Poor Europe. And Persona 4 is probably one of my favorite JRPGs of all time. It was my first introduction to the Persona series, and, you know, the interesting thing is that this came out a couple years into the PS3's lifespan at that point, a year or two, so...
Persona 4 was a PS2 game.
I know, that's what I'm saying is that it's kind of surprising in some ways that this was a PS2 game and not game.
I see what you're saying, well played.
That said, it really pushed the PS2 to its limits. It's a beautiful-looking game. And, you know, I think what really appealed to me, and I'd been familiar with the Shin Megami Tensei series, but I really love the way that the social links, and you know, this is true to a degree with, you know, Persona 3, but the way that the social links affect the development of your persona, because as the protagonist, you can wield any number of persona. Your friends only have, you know, the one persona that they have. But, I mean, I thought that was really interesting. Almost, you know, it's easy to say, like, a Pokemon sort of element to it. I was describing it to someone the other day as also being similar to, like, the Guardian Forces of the Final Fantasy VIII experience. Because, you kind of had to, like, junction magic. And, you know, it depends on what magic spells you have. Depend on what personas are equipped. And like I said, a lot of this is also true for Persona 3, but just coming from someone who had not played any Persona games before, those were the things that really drew me to it. I loved playing through the school life things. You know, you have to, like, do pop quizzes, and you can join a club. So, you know, it's very much like a school life sim. And then, in the afternoons after school, you can go into the television world where you're fighting shadows. And, you know, it's combined with a really good murder mystery story. And so, you know, you really get to, you know these characters. And I'll let Captain Spike talk a little bit about, these characters, you know, had some really interesting story elements and, you know, character elements to them.
So, for me, one of the big things that I really, really love about Persona 4 is that so basically every, like, real dungeon in the game is sort of rooted in a different character's sort of neuroses.
Right?
And it's not necessarily, like, strictly neuroses, but, like, let's take, for example, a character we've talked about here on the show literally hundreds of times at this point, Kanji. We had a back and forth in our social links section of the show, a segment, about Kanji's sexuality. Slaggy and I come down on the side that he's you know, gay or at least questioning, whereas many of our listeners felt that he was a heterosexual. But what can't really be denied is that his sort of issue in the game, the character development that focuses on his psychological issues, are largely his struggle with society's rigidity with regard to gender norms and expectations of societal expectations relating to same. He is, you know, a character who overcompensates on, like, being butch and being a bully because he also likes to sew and likes pretty things.
Likes to make little plushy toys.
Well, exactly. And, you know, his character is sort of codified in by Japanese imagery, you know, big muscle men with roses in their mouths, the whole sort of bara aesthetic that you also see represented in something like Choaniki.
Or like the hard gay...
The whole hard gay stereotype that Japanese humor loves to play with. And to me, I actually see it as a plus that so many people can read this so differently, because to me that's really an important part of art and appreciation, is really that reader response element of what you bring to the table.
Well, I think what's really significant, too, is not only was this game released in 2008, and, I mean, it's a Japanese game, so for a Japanese game to be exploring issues of gender between that story and the Naoto story, you know, which comes up with even more issues of gender expression and ties into kanjis, and, you know, I mean, I would even say, like, Yukiko's story deals with her, you know, it has some, like, gender elements, too, and, you know, Chie is kind of, like, you know, sometimes, like, presented as really butch. I mean, I think there's, like, a lot more discussion, I mean, even just with gender alone, you know, and for this to be brought up in a 2008 Japanese JRPG, I think that's really significant, because, I mean, when you think about kind of Western society and how our discussions about gender have really, you know, only come to be, you know, a lot more in depth over the past couple years. I mean, I feel like, you know, specifically this being a Japanese game, that's really notable.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, did you mention Naoto?
Yeah, very briefly, you know.
Because, and what context? Because I mean, if it, you must have mentioned it so briefly that I missed it.
Well, and we did talk about this on, one of our episodes where we talked about queer issues, but for, you know, for new listeners or people who are not listening or who need a refresher, Naoto initially presents as male, as a kind of, not legendary, but like a, you know, what do they call that, you know? A brilliant young boy detective.
Respected boy detective.
You know, a young child genius, sort of, a prodigy. Like a prodigy boy detective. But then, you know, Naoto's dungeon is all about, you know, her gender expression, their gender expression. I don't know, really. I think they just ended up using
I believe ultimately she does identify as female.
Right, but I mean...
But her whole shadow world is really about like her resentment.
Gender reassignment surgery.
Well, yeah, it's... I mean, it's really a trip, and like you said, you know, when you think about the fact that this is a Japanese game in 2008 dealing with some of these issues, it is just so mind-blowingly ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And for, like, for me, Persona 4 was really the game where everyone sat up and took notice, like... This is an amazing game. This is an amazing experience. You know, the user interface of, and I'm going to get away from the story elements a little bit slaggy.
Mm-hmm.
The user interface, which is now something that the Persona games are well known for.
Oh, super stylized and slick.
Everything is super stylized and super slick. And all of the, like, opening movies and stuff are just beautiful, set to amazing music. Another thing that Persona is now known for is its amazing music. And, you know, there have been several spin-offs of the Persona series. We haven't, this is the last real Persona game that has released as of this date, but there is Persona 5 coming. But in the interim, you know, Persona's really become known and loved for its presentation with regard to UI, graphic style, presentation as far as the music and, like,
yeah, I would
cinematics
say, like, go.
It
initially struck me, reminded me a lot in the visual aesthetic of, Cowboy Bebop. Musically, and kind of like, if you think about the opening sequence of Cowboy Bebop, if you're an anime fan or, you know, you're familiar with that, like, just very stylized and, you know, the music, you know, very intentionally, like, trying to, like, you know, set a certain mood and vibe.
Yeah, absolutely. Tone and atmosphere.
And I know you said you wanted to get away from the story a little bit, but I really
think... Okay, then take it where you need it to go, man.
No, just kind of touching. You know, I'm not going to go into, you know, individual stories, but like what you were talking about, you know, that each dungeon is kind of based in a character's neurosis or something. I think it really kind of brought the Persona series full circle. Because, you know, you think about the whole arcana of the Persona series be kind of like the whole, like, Jungian psychology, you know, having the roots in that element. And so I thought it really, I think that's what really, you know, struck a chord with me is that just the whole package just works together really well. And then on top of that, it's like you got this murder mystery to solve. And, oh, fun time school life. And moving in with your sexy uncle who's a police officer.
Ooh, Dojima.
Yum. Oh, yeah, Dojima-san is very Delphi.
Persona 4, of course, as Slaggy had sort of mentioned as an aside, did get a Vita remake enhanced port called Persona 4 the Golden. So they added some stuff to Persona 4 the Golden. They added a new character, Marie.
Oh, Marie.
They added social links for Marie and a character, Adachi-san.
Who we just talked about for Dancing All Night.
Well, exactly. Overall, really great experience. If you're going to play it, Persona 4 the Golden is probably the way to go. Story has been adapted to anime twice.
Yeah.
Persona 4 the animation and Persona 4 Golden the animation.
And I would just have to say, you know, this isn't anime buoy, but... If you're really interested in playing the Persona series, play through Persona 4 first, either one, before you watch the anime, because the anime is really good, but it's literally the story of the game, you know. Of course, you know, the main character kind of develops in a, you know, a way that they chose, you know, but, I mean, literally, it's the story of the game, and the interesting thing about Persona 4 the Golden anime is that, I don't know if this was ever... actually confirmed, but it seemed to be a new game plus, which is really kind of a cute way, but might make it very confusing if you just try to jump into that. So, but you know, still both very, very faithful to the games.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, the thing is, I think we all kind of agree from a fan perspective that Persona 4 the Golden is like a new game plus retelling of the story, but I don't believe it's ever been officially confirmed. So that's definitely something that's sort of interesting. They did add in new elements from Persona 4 the Golden, including, you know, like Marie.
Yeah, a lot of it just focuses on Marie, so...
Yeah.
A lot of things are cut out, I feel.
So, anyway, if you do watch the anime, I'd actually recommend you watch them both, but ultimately, play the game first.
Yeah.
The storyline continues in Persona 4 Arena and Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, as well as Persona Q Shadow of the Labyrinth. And Persona 4 Dancing All Night, the rhythm game that we've been talking about here on the show a lot over the last year since it was announced.
Yeah, let's talk about these real quick.
It came out in Japan last week. We do have a copy here in studio, and we will be talking about it. But let's finish up our look at the core series, Slaggy, by talking about Persona 5 a little bit.
Oh, yes.
Then we'll talk about the spinoffs. Persona 5 is still slated... for a quarter 4 2015 release worldwide.
I need it now.
This is going to be a PS3 and PS4 release. It has been confirmed that the social link system will be returning, although in an altered form. And there's apparently going to be, you know, the ability to actually equip, like, personas, as I understand it, and multiple weapon types, which that's actually a mainstay from Persona and Shin Megami Tensei generally, that you'll be able to have ranged weapon equipped and melee weapons equipped. So that's actually going to be really interesting. We don't know a lot about the game yet, other than it focuses on the protagonist who is recently transferred to school in Japan. He becomes best friends with two other students and a talking cat.
Can we just mention that... Persona 4 has a talking teddy suit.
Oh, yeah. Persona 4 has a talking teddy bear suit, known in the U.S. as Teddy and in Japan as Kuma, which is the Japanese word for
bear. And we're
not
going to spoil anything for you, but I would say that definitely Persona 4 was not afraid to take things a little more fantastical. I mean, when you consider there's already shadows and demons and personas and all of that, but, you know... I think Persona 4 definitely had a little bit of fun with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, the protagonist, feeling suppressed by his life, begins to live a second life as a burglar called the Phantom. And he basically carries out, you know, like, heists while encountering supernatural phenomena.
Oh, I am so excited.
So, the game, it just looks so weird. It looks really cool. Super stylized, like, very similar to anime. Specifically, like, super stylized, almost like a Cowboy Bebop or a Read or Die type thing. I'm absolutely super, super, super excited for this game. And I really cannot wait to learn more and to finally play it. The music is beautiful. There are some new, trailers for it. The recent release of, Dancing All Night came with a Blu-ray with the new trailer on it for Persona 5. It's really cool. I highly, highly, highly recommend you look into it if you haven't yet. Just superb stuff. Persona 5 is going to be just nuts awesome. So with all of that having been discussed, let's start talking about the spin-offs. And I want to start this conversation talking about a spin-off, Slaggy, that I think you're probably not thinking of. And we'll go from there. The first Persona spin-off I want to talk about is a little game released for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 in 2011 called Catherine.
Oh, okay.
Now, Catherine, at first blush, it is made by Persona Team. It was specifically Persona Team's efforts to get an HD engine in place that could handle the visuals that people would expect from a Persona-style game. It has been described as adult-oriented in official Atlas materials, but the thing that I like the most, and I talk about this here a lot on the show, is that Catherine is adult not because LOL boobs or LOL violence, LOL sex, but it deals with very adult, real-life, mature themes.
Not high school stuff.
Not high school stuff. No, you know, the main character is a man who is being pressured by his long-term girlfriend to finally get married. He falls in with a beautiful mystery woman after a super drunken night who happens to share the same name. And as
Catherine.
Catherine, yes. It's there in the title.
They're both named Catherine.
They are both named Catherine, one with a C, one with a K. And basically, the story is a huge part of this game. It's like a playable anime, almost. Except every night, Vincent has nightmares, which he believes are related to sort of this ongoing social thing that's happening in his world, where men are dying in their sleep. Young men all dying in their sleep, waking, like, being found with horrified looks on their faces. And the story, and I don't want to say too much, but, you know, obviously if people are having dreams that kill them, we're dealing with fantasy. This very much in the true ending of the game, this game has like 9 different endings. In the true ending, it is very clearly tied into Persona and Shin Megami Tensei over at large. It's pretty overtly connected to that universe. But, something that's really cool is the gameplay it's actually a puzzle game. I can't really explain it so much as, like, it's a puzzle game. It has a competitive mode that is actually played at EVO. We've talked about it here on the show. It's like a block puzzle game, but in a very three-dimensional way. I can't really think of a good way to explain it, but if you have a PS3 or a 360 and you're interested in narrative game storytelling, like, and how, you know, games can tell stories in ways that other media really can't, I highly recommend you play Catherine. It is a superb, superb experience. I can't possibly speak highly enough about it. And for me, you know, it's almost like, even though it's a spin-off, if you were to ask me what my favorite game in this whole family of games is, Catherine would rank pretty highly. So, Slaggy, have you spent much time with Catherine?
I haven't, but it's a very weird game.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely bizarre. Vincent, as we mentioned, appears as a cameo in Persona 3 Portable, and we're all pretty sure that he's going to be appearing in Persona 5 as well, based on an appearance of a character who looks identical to him in the first video trailer for the game.
I have to ask, did you get the Catherine Deluxe Edition?
I did not. Is that the one that came in the pizza box that came with boxers?
Yes.
Yeah, I did not. I kind of wish I had. But that's all right.
Oh, Vincent.
Anyway, but to be a little bit more on the ball. The first big spinoff of the Persona series was a fighting game sequel to Persona 4. This is Persona 4 Arena. It released in arcades in Japan in 2012 and got console releases in Japan and North America in 2012 and a 2013 release in the EU regions. Something really notable about P4A, as we call it, Persona 4 Arena, is that despite being a fighting game, it has a fully voiced story mode that is really straight up like a 10-plus hour story mode. You end up going through, like, long periods of just storytelling in between actual battles in the story mode. The game was done by Arc System Works, who is one of the premier studios for fighting games. You're probably familiar with their work on Guilty Gear.
Blaze Blue.
On Blaze Blue. So it's actually, it's a very well-loved fighting game. Has all of the characters you would want to play as from specifically Persona 4, as well as a handful of characters from Persona 3, like I mentioned earlier. And it actually does, again, you know, it's a real sequel. It takes place after Persona 4, and actually, like, goes a long way of bringing in new story elements. It is available on PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. And, unfortunately, it was actually removed from the PlayStation Network in the EU territories, but you can otherwise still get it, from PlayStation Network or Xbox Live. So, definitely easy to get into. And it got a sequel, which, if you're a long-term listener, you probably remember when we talked about this game quite a bit. This is Persona 4 Arena Ultimax. Or, if you're in Japan, Persona 4 the Ultimax Ultra Super Suplex Hold or something. still made by Arc System Works, has even more story elements to the game, and more Persona 3 characters. You know, it's a good expansion to the game from a fighting game perspective. And again, the storyline goes even deeper. And actually mixes in Persona 4 lore and Persona 3 to sort of canonically connect them. So if you're interested in Persona 3 and Persona 4, I would almost call the two fighting games like must plays. Like, maybe you have to put the game on easy so that you can get through the fighting stuff to get the story. But I
heard the judgment in your voice.
There was a little, because I like really, really hard games. But if you're in these games for the story, and being JRPGs, you probably are, I would actually recommend the arena games as must-plays. From there, we go to a different spinoff. This one is for the 3DS. This is called Persona Q Shadow of the Labyrinth.
Yeah, also something we talked about very much on Game Movie.
Indeed. And, Saige, I know you recently purchased
Literally on Friday, so with the holiday, I have not had a chance to pop it in yet.
Okay, it's cool. Something really interesting about Persona Q is that it actually borrows a lot of its gameplay inspiration from the Etrian Odyssey series. A lot of people at the time, of course, were talking about, oh, well, this is weird because it's a dungeon crawler. But, like,
I have to draw my maps.
That's weird to me because the Persona games for the dungeons typically do have dungeon crawler elements. So, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Either way, it does advance the storyline further from Persona 3, Persona 4, and Persona Arena. So it's already automatically should play if you're interested in these characters' stories. But something that's interesting is that it actually does fuse the kinds of combat and character, enemy encounters that you would see in the Etrian Odyssey series to what you would find in the Persona series. It really is a fusion of the two that I actually think is really quite cool. I think it's really neat that they did this. This released in Japan on June 5th, 2014, in Korea, October 23rd, 2014, North America, November 25th, 2014, November 28th, 2014 for the EU territories, and Australia got it on December 4th, 2014.
Oh, poor Australia.
I don't want to talk too much about the story here, because, you know, it's actually still a relatively new game, but the story is actually pretty well done. It was, I bought this game in prep for this show. I hadn't picked it up yet. And I was actually really surprised by the story. So, it's very neat. I recommend you play it if you're interested in you know, dungeon crawly 3DS fun times. Really not as different of an experience from the other Persona game, from those two Persona games as you might expect. First person dungeons, everybody working together in combat, getting, you know, the once more mechanic because that is still present. It's just, it's a really cool experience. And the last of these spin-offs that I really want to talk about here is Persona 4 Dancing All Night. This released in Japan on June 25th, 2015. It will be releasing in North America September 29th, 2015, and it'll be hitting the EU territories in the fall of 2015, and that goes for Australia as well. This is a single-player rhythm game for PlayStation Vita, and something really interesting about it, from a gameplay perspective, it is very, very, very similar to the Hatsune Miku Project Diva series. But the story mode is actually super in-depth, like it's a real Persona story. It takes place, and this is sort of interesting because it takes place in after the epilogue of Persona 4 Golden, but it also has a second story mode that's hidden that takes place even later in the storyline. So this game just has, you know, the new canonical storyline all over the place. And it, the music, you know, as we were talking about how Persona 3 and 4 are really known for their music, Persona 4 in particular, the remixes in this game are just insane. The music is superb. They even got, you know, some really cool musicians to come do remixes for this, including Akira Yamaoka from formerly of Konami. You're probably familiar with his work from Dance Dance Revolution and Silent Hill.
Yeah.
So it's also gotten a lot of post-release DLC support. I've put in a few hours on this game already. The story, as I understand it, if you let everything play out at its voiced rate, because it's a fully voiced game, it's supposed to actually be about 10 hours of content, which is just nuts to me. It's the story mode in a rhythm game. But anyway, the game is great, especially if you like Hatsune Miku-style rhythm games. I can't really recommend it enough. Slaggy, I know you've played this one. What do you think?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, like you said, if you like the Hatsune Miku games and you like Persona, even if you're not familiar with Persona and you don't like JRPGs at all, but you love Hatsune Miku-style games, yeah, definitely pick it up. Great music, fun gameplay, even if you're not interested at all in the story.
Yep, absolutely. So I actually think this about wraps it up for our conversation on Persona. There's actually, you know, I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about. There was
like that
series,
online sequel to Persona 3.
Which isn't available here, but yeah.
Yeah, which is why we didn't really talk about it.
You know, there were the Persona 3 movies that are actually quite popular in Japan. I mean, really, there's a lot to Persona. This is a series that is well-loved. It does well. People just adore it. There are constant manga coming out for these series. We talked about that here on the show recently, that we're
yep.
going to be seeing some of that manga coming to North America. But we've really gone long here.
There have even been
stage plays. Well, yeah, I mean, stage plays. But we've really gone long here. I didn't intend for us to talk about Persona quite as long as we did. So I really want to wrap this up, Slaggy. Overall, what do you love about the Persona series?
I just love that it combines so many different styles of gameplay into one. And, you know, I appreciate that it's very uniquely Japanese in a lot of ways, which is interesting considering that, you know, they tried to Revelations Persona and super Americanize it. Like, I appreciate that it's like Japanese school life. And then, you know, like, even like a lot of the monsters are, you know, rooted in, I'm sorry, the shadows and the personas are rooted in Japanese mythology and stuff. So, you know, I really love that it's a very different style of JRPG.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just the, like we've talked about, particularly with 3 and 4, just the overall polish, the visual aesthetic, the music. It's, I mean, these are, like, I would really say works of art.
Excellent. That's awesome. I actually would largely agree with, what you just said.
Exploring subversive things and...
For me, the thing that I love about Persona, I love how dark it started. You know, that's what hooked me when I was a little guy. But what I really love about the games now are, like I said, you know, the character development you get through social links. It's something that as I became an adult and became more, sort of mature, I guess, maybe. you know, I really felt like JRPGs maybe didn't have as much character development as I thought when I was a kid playing Final Fantasy 4 and 6 and, you know, playing on emulators, Final Fantasy 5. I always thought, like, oh, these characters have a lot of character development. And, you know, Final Fantasy 6 kind of does, but the others maybe not so much. Persona 3 and 4 in particular were the first times as an adult that I felt like these games have the amount of character development that I thought I was getting from Final Fantasy when I was a kid. And I absolutely love these explorations of these worlds. I love these explorations of sort of what makes people tick and the ways that societal expectation, you know, repress us and confine us. I very much connect and relate to most of the struggles of Persona 4 in particular. And I just think it's really incredible from a storytelling and art standpoint, you know, that these games can communicate that way. I just think it's very special. I think that it's something that you couldn't really do in any other medium. And I just absolutely think that the Persona series is a treasure. Saigi, if someone were listening to this episode, they never played a Persona game, now they're interested in playing a Persona game, what would the suggested jumping off point be?
Persona 3.
All right, and what version of Persona 3?
I would say whatever. I mean, it definitely depends on what they have. If they have...
You mean by in terms of console?
Yes, but really based on what you've heard, based on if you think you would prefer something like kind of point-and-clicky or something more traditional. I think that, you know, you could just jump into Persona 4, but I think that you might appreciate Persona 4 even more. That, you know, on its own, it's just a spectacular game, but I think you'd really be able to appreciate like what it's done playing through Persona 3 first.
All right. I would probably recommend that people, if they have the choice, just jump right in with Persona 4 the Golden. Just get right to that killer, no-filler experience. And then work your way backwards from there. Play 4, then play 3 Portable, then play the PSP remakes of 2. If you can only play the first PSP remake of 2, and then you have to play the PS1 port, that's fine. Or the PS1 PSN release, that's fine. But I absolutely think that there's a lot of value in starting with 4 in this day and age, because it really, what JRPGs are right now, I think is in big part due to the impact that Persona 4 had 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when it released. Oh man, maybe even 7 now. that's where it is for me. I think that if you're interested in playing Persona, just cut right to what makes it so special, and then watch that evolution in reverse. And then just stop when the gameplay gets too archaic for you, I guess. And any final words before we start on with our last couple segments before we end the show? We're already nearly 2 hours deep.
No, just that I'm really excited to see where the series is going to go. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think it's hit its peak yet. You know, I think it's just continuing to get even better and better. And I think Persona 5 is going to be amazing game of the year material. So I have so much hype for it.
Awesome. All right, then. Let's talk about some rumors.
Oh, don't you want to do some social links first? Seeing that we are talking about Persona.
Oh, would you like to do our social links now? Well, let's do our social links now.
So over on Twitter, we asked this week, we're talking about the Persona series. Which game is your favorite and why? Asymmetrical Homo said P4G had the most realized vision, so I'm going with that. That's, of course, Persona 4 Golden. Sky, better known as Rob Robert, said, I'm surprised Shane Alenko isn't trying to crash on this episode. Shane replied, I can't hear you over all this dancing all night I'm loving. Your enzyme replying, I want to play. The wait for the restaurant release is killing me. That Retro Code replied to the question of the week with Persona 3 Fest. The music, story, social links, and combining personas were great. Your enzyme had been talking about, and we'll get into that a little more with our general feedback and social media later, but it started a P3 portable playthrough saying, oh, I'm not going to be able to finish P3P before Sunday. It was an impossible task. But it says, well, P4G is my fave. It's single-handedly renewed my love for JRPGs, but they're all special to me. Happy emoticon. Over on Facebook, we asked the same question, along with the Bonus question, which character's journey was your favorite in the later Persona games? And we got a response from Nathan B. If you're a listener to Reading is Fundamental, this is Nathan BL, who has a very special name on that podcast, saying, like many, I have the strongest feelings for Persona 4. Mechanically, it's just so well-rounded. Persona 1 and 3 have gameplay flaws that prevent me liking them as much. As a UK resident, I haven't had much opportunity to play the Persona 2 titles, but I know they have their own fan base. As a queer dude, I really click with the story beats for Kanji and Naoto in P4. Naoto is my favorite character in general, especially in P4 Arena. It's a shame that they downplayed that side of them in all the media they have appeared in since the original PS2 game. Interesting.
That's awesome. Do we got anything else?
No, we'll just hit our other social medias after we do the other segments.
Awesome. Then let's talk about some rumors.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
This first one is a potentially big deal. Ubisoft has a... Australian. I will always call them Ubi. I do not care. Has a entry on the Australian Classification Board database for Zombie for Xbox One. This is very likely the somewhat connected to the somewhat recent leak over at Unseen64, which is a very popular and very reliable source for games that were in development but canceled. Unseen64 was reporting that they had a source that revealed to them that Zombie U was getting a PS4, Xbox One, and PC port just titled Zombie. For that leak to have happened, and then a week later for this rating to have popped up, it seems like a where there's smoke, there's fire situation to me. Slaggy, this other one is big news connecting to a news story that you were talking about earlier. Basically, there was an interview at Japan Expo the day after Yuji Horii's comments that we were talking about earlier about Dragon Quest 7 and 8. And Horii actually said, you know, to this interviewer, Dragon Quest 7 and Dragon Quest 8 are on their way to 3DS in French. And the translator, his translator at this event, got visibly angry when this happened. So, you know, we have the official comment at this same event where Horii-san said it was something that Square Enix was very aware that we all want super bad. And he basically said outright the next day in interview that it is a thing that's happening, like now. And his translator was like, no, we ain't supposed to talk about that.
Oh,
so again, you know, we tend only to report on things when they seem very, very likely, even rumors. We don't want to talk about some rumor that is just never gonna happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been saying even here on the show for a long time that I feel like this is an inevitability. And this to me just, it's hard for me to believe that Yuji Horii doesn't know what's going on with the Western releases of Dragon Quest games. Like, he's a man who would know, and if he let it slip, it seems very likely to me that it's happening.
You know, that Ubisoft news makes me want to post a reaction GIF.
I see what you did there! Let's talk about a smash! So our first smash this week is over at Gamma Sutra. I'm a big fan of Gamma. If you're reading this, if you're listening to this, you probably are too. This is actually a great outtake. It's an excerpt, as I understand it, from Gabe Durham's book Bible Adventures. And it's basically about the creation of the SNES Wolfenstein clone Super 3D Noah's Ark.
I always forget that that was a Wolfenstein clone.
And it actually, something that that is funny to me is that it actually has all of the same maps as Wolfenstein. Like, from a gameplay perspective, it's basically just Wolfenstein with a different skin. That is amazing to me. If you're interested in weird games and, like, sort of, like, design stories and stuff, I think this is a must-read. We'll link you to it over on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org!
And the other smash this week is a piece that was run by US Gamer, where Kensuke Tanabe-san, whom you're probably most familiar with as the guy who is, you know, primarily responsible in the way that we think about it for Super Mario Bros. 2. You know, the version that of what we call Super Mario Bros. 2, which in Japan is Super Mario USA or whatever. Doki Doki Panic, you know? either way, it's a really interesting piece on Super Mario Brothers 2 elements in Super Mario Maker. It seems kind of unlikely it's going to happen now, unfortunately, even though I previously had thought that it definitely would happen as, like, DLC or just, like, a free patch after release. But either way, it's really interesting to read. Unique perspective here to hear from Tanabe-san himself talking about Super Mario Brothers 2's place in the Super Mario lore in the modern age. I know that's something that Slaggy actually talks about IRL a lot.
Yes.
So I would also call this one a must-read. If you're interested in talking about games online, these are the kinds of articles that I think we all need. So check them out. Enjoy them as much as I did. Pass these links on. And, you know, if you're thinking about writing about games, I think that this is a good spot to aim for.
Yeah.
Unless we have anything else, it's time to talk about what's going on.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So I'm just going to start out here because I've already talked about one of them in this episode, and one's just a continuation of what I've been playing. Just a side note, I've been really wanting to get back into PC gaming, but my laptop just died, and my desktop computer needs a new PSQ, so kind of out of commission right there. So my gaming has mostly been focused on more Smash Brothers, really starting to get a lot more comfortable with Roy, our boy. I'm not sure if he's my main yet, but really doing pretty well with him, as far as I'm concerned. And then also Persona 4 Dancing All Night, having a lot of fun with it. It's your copy, awesome. To be fair, but, you know.
Yeah, but still, you enjoyed it, and that's the important part. I have primarily been playing Persona 4 Dancing All Night, really loving it. And on the side, I've been playing a lot of Final Fantasy 14.
Big surprise.
Basically logging in every day to do my duty roulettes and stuff.
Doing your what?
And, you know, really working on leveling my my Lancer / Dragoon. I mean, I guess she's a Dragoon now, but...
How much duty do you have to do?
This character I'm playing is my original main. I finally paid for a server transfer and got her somewhere where I'm more comfortable playing. And I'm just really loving it. I'm really, really, really enjoying my time with this game. Finally seeing new content that I didn't see back when I was first playing when Realm Reborn hit. Finally seeing new stuff from that and just absolutely in love all over again. Spending some time every day in the Gold Saucer, too, and just having a great time. I can't really overstate how much I'm enjoying Final Fantasy
XIV. I'm
going to
have to join you once I get my PC back up and running.
I hope you do. I hope you do. I'm playing on Cactar. And
lots of duty around the Cactar.
That's probably why recently every time I've been in public, I've done a little Cactar pose.
That's the thing that's happened.
All right, well, why don't you get the rest of those social links out there?
All right, so we've got a lot of Twitter tweets to...
Twiddly-twiddly-tweet,
to catch up on. Our first one comes from Morning Wolf on Twitter, linking us to a news article about a man spending 6.5 years crocheting the Super Mario Bros. 3 map. Have you seen that, Captain Spike?
Yes, and it's amazing.
It's amazing, and we love that Morning Wolf brought it to our attention, thought of us when this popped up in the news. Emiru69 said, I love that the last episode of GameBuie.org was optimistic about Nintendo's E3. It's called E3 2015, talk about 2015 games. And that sparked a little bit of a discussion. You had chimed in about, you know, that a lot of people were hyped about the CGI concept trailers, but we need more than that. And Amiri continued, exactly. I get people's hype, but how many projects presented in E3 have been canceled in the last 3 years? The last few years.
I'm just going to look sadly over at Phantom Dust right now.
Aw. Sky, Rob Roberts, playing Devil's Advocate, saying, did you say that in 2014 when they showed 2015 games? Amir saying, I can't remember, LOL. It was only a year away. If it was only a year away, I'll be happy. Example, Final Fantasy VII has not started development yet. Sky chiming in, Sony did a great job of smoke and mirrors, yes, but I think Microsoft outdid both specifically for holiday 2015.
Well, and, you know, that actually fits with what I was saying in our E3 wrap-up, mm-hmm. that, you know, removed from the hype and the megatons, I really ultimately felt that Microsoft put on, you know, the best short and long-term balance.
Right. And Rob continues, obviously I'm buying Mario Maker and Star Fox, duh, but I knew that at E3 2014. And that's really interesting because, you know, those of us who are on the Nintendo hype train, like, all the time, or Nintendo fans for life, Nintendo fanboys, fangirls, whatever you want to call us, we pretty much say, oh, anything first party we'll buy. You know, so that might kind of skew our perspective a little bit that, you know, things that aren't like OMG. But Oh Hey DJ seemed to agree with us in a Miru 69 saying, finally, people that agree with me. And then there's a gif of a girl twerking on a wall. It's amazing. Continuing the E3 wrap-up discussion, Miru saying, I didn't care about any of the titles Microsoft presented in E3 except for its collection. Atari Barbie, better known as Ian from the Koopa Club podcast, saying, I think Xbox One won this holiday
too. I'm not editing that out.
I know you're not. Ian saying, I think Xbox One won this holiday too, especially if the BC shit is awesome. Rob continuing, I have tepid optimism regarding the BC. When Lost Odyssey is on the list, it'll be rabid enthusiasm.
And I have to say, I haven't had a chance to play with it yet, but I got into the Xbox Dashboard Preview program last week, so I should have some input on what that BC is like pretty soon.
Very cool. Ian continuing, okay, well, I'm optimistic as hell, because I didn't have a 360. Don't rain on my parade. Nails emoji. Love the nails emoji. Amir 69 continuing, BC is awesome. About Expo, and I love JRPG, so it's not my first choice. I love Lost Odyssey and Blue Lagoon. Book Pirate continuing, what about Rare's new pirate game? I love pirate games. Aw, it's our book pirate. Pirate friend. Pirate, 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 pirate. Amir 69 saying, it looks fun. I like Xbox titles, but my back catalog is big. My motivation for more consoles is low. And kind of wrapping it up, You were saying that, you know, you basically had said these things on the show. And Rob saying, you know, you may stand Nintendo, but you have a level head with MS and Sony. I try very hard to as well. Amir was saying, at the end of the day, competition is very good for consumers. So really awesome discussion just unfolding from, you know, a tweet that started talking about our reaction to E3 2015. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, listeners, and people who maybe don't listen but just found themselves in that thread.
Yeah,
heart,
yeah.
Y'all.
Speaking of new potential listeners, we have to thank Oh Hey DJ for saying, you know, someone was looking for some video game podcast recommendations. And DJ said, have you listened to GameBuoy.org, Koopa Club, or VG Realness? And the tweeter, TweedleVee, said, I have not, but I will def check them out. Thanks.
Awesome!
Spike Point said, I'm super biased here, but you can't go wrong with any of these. Slagkick said, I heard that First Mate Slagkick from Gay Buoy is too gay to function. Hey. Gamer Fox, one of our lovely listeners that we are always happy to hear from, said, these are all great podcasts. Heart emoji, heart emoji. Aww. And then to wrap up, we just had I just want to shout out that Urenzum and I had a great little discussion about leading up to Persona. And, you know, as we mentioned, your enzyme had said, just started P3P, so glad I bought this PSTV. Yeah, like, the PSTV, like, I'm actually really surprised.
Yeah.
And last but certainly not least, Katar E37 saying, for some reason your feed on iTunes isn't working correctly again. I didn't get a notice about E3D2, E3 wrap-up not showing up at all. Well, drats. I wanted to address that because I apologize for any sort of inconvenience that's caused anyone. I still have not heard back from Apple when I initially looked into this, so I'm going to have to follow up on that. In the meantime, I hope that won't deter you all from listening. We are working on that. And speaking of which, we love your feedback. I'm going to start out by saying if you are having trouble with us on iTunes, again, my sincerest apologies, but if you have access to Stitcher Radio, that might be a great place to check us out in the meantime, which is updating as expected. But like I said, we love your feedback. We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews, even when iTunes isn't working quite right. We like your Facebook likes, and we fucking love Twitter. Some great Twitter conversations going on this week. And if you want to send us an email, especially if you are a backlog Betty or Barney Rubble, apparently, you can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Or just anytime you want. It doesn't have to be based on, you know, an episode question of the week or whatever. Everything is always available, including episodes that you can stream from the site. We have plenty of bandwidth, so, like, you know, it's not even a big deal. You can go right over to GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
Where you can hear all 86 of these. Wow.
Holy cats.
Holy cats. Captain Spike, unless you have anything else to add, I think we have some shout-outs to shout-out.
As ever and always, I'd recommend you check out VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, as well as the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. I'd also suggest you go to Nintendo Fun Club, your one-stop shop for platformers, positivity, and pop-punk. As well as their sister show, Enos Lives, a really inventive, cute little show focusing on some of your very favorite and not-so-favorite PS1 classics. I'd also recommend you check out the Nintendo Love Fest, hosted by one of the hosts from the X-Nation podcast. That is, of course, an X-Men podcast you can find over at http://culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. There's also Slag Kicks, currently off-season show rating is fundamental, in which we all, by which I mean myself, he, Rob Roberts, and Delvin from VG Realness, take a look at RuPaul's Drag Race, usually being pretty bitchy, and always being a lot of fun. If you're a Star Trek fan, you need to go check out the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, and last but never, ever, ever least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Now, Slaggy, please take us to a game bar.
Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch. I would also like to mention another Hunty Bunch show, which is Koopa Club. That's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist. They just celebrated 3 years. Congrats to them.
Congrats. And,
congrats to the awards that they received from their moms. That's not shade. That's the award that they got, and they're very proud of it. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network, that's vognetwork.com, you can listen to great shows such as some of the ones that Captain Spike had mentioned, but also including Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO. That's World of Warcraft, of course. And Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously. I'd like to shout out to the Multi-Tap Podcast over on FistfulOfPotions.com. That's a podcast discussion in the round about gaming then and now. And last but certainly not least, La Palanca Podcast. Podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. As ever and always, our wonderful theme music was done by the late, great Zelda Reorchestrator, the project that aimed to orchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They shuttered their castle doors quite a while back, but will forever be pouring a 40 for them in the Great Fairy Fountain.
All right, our lovely and beautiful listeners, thank you once again for spending a lovely late Sunday evening with us. Hopefully you have enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed talking to all of you. We absolutely love the Persona games, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you about them. We will probably do a follow-up to this episode once Persona 5 comes out in our micro format, so please look forward to that.
I was just thinking about that.
But in the meantime, keep gaming, keep thinking, and Kage Nuki.
All the lesbians, all the lesbians, na 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 na, lesbians.
Oh, are you serious?
That's what it sounds like.
Done.
Blue. Glim glim, vile plim. Here's some vile news.
Pause.
Oh my gosh.
Pause.
Probably most people
most listeners would probably be familiar with that. It's been all over the news.
I need you to say that again louder.
Pause. Wait, my favorite Shin Megami Tensei spinoff is Jack Rose. Oh, wait, that's my favorite something else.
Okay, I need you to say that louder again. I know that you were trying to do wilting, but you have to do, like,
I know.
Sotto voce or something.
Pause.